Welcome back to the Strong and Lean at Any Age podcast. I am Susan Niebergall, and today I am speaking with Dr. Alyssa Kuhn. I found Alyssa on Instagram. She is a PT that specializes in osteoarthritis. And since I have been recently diagnosed with arthritis, I really want to learn as much as I can about arthritis. And so I wanted to bring Alyssa on here so I could learn more about arthritis and so that you can learn more about arthritis and really hear the message that just because you have arthritis doesn't mean you can't do things. And I think this message is so important. So Alyssa and I have a great conversation about all the things that she recommends you do when you have arthritis and how to manage it. And I personally learned so much from this conversation, and I think you will as well. So go grab your coffee, put up your feet, take a listen, or put on those AirPods and get walking and take a listen. Let's get on with the episode. Hey, Alyssa, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
Great. It is so great to see you. I mean, you and I can see each other as we do this. That's why I love having the video piece while we're actually having a conversation, because I feel like it makes it go easier for us.
Yes. It is much more intimate too, I feel like, instead of just like talking to a black screen.
I totally agree. I am so excited for this conversation. You and I were talking off air just a second ago. This is personal for me now, you know. It's interesting, you know. I'm 61, going to be 62 in like a month and a half. And, you know, a lot of things have changed, you know, a lot of things have changed, you know, just as we get older. And I've joined the arthritis game now. And it's interesting because after I have you introduce yourself, I want to explain to you how it came across, how I came across my diagnosis, because it all makes perfect sense to me now on what I've been experiencing for so long. But anyway, tell everyone who you are, what you do, and, you know, let us get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So thank you so much for having me. So my name's Alyssa. I am a doctor of physical therapy, and I have kind of stumbled into this niche of helping people with osteoarthritis. And it stemmed from a couple of years ago. We moved here to Utah from Ohio. And I mean, there's all sorts of mountains and outdoor things to do. And then I started seeing people privately with Keep the Adventure Alive. And I got to meet so many people initially that were dealing with some degree of arthritis, and a lot of their mobility impairments, a lot of their pain seemed to stem from arthritis. And it's one of the most common condition. Well, one of the very common conditions, especially kind of once you hit 50 and over. But it's being diagnosed younger and younger. And so I started kind of diving into some of the research and things, and it was amazing to me how much negativity is out there. And I just posted something today on Instagram about, I met someone the other day who was told literally to stop doing stairs. For the rest of their lives.
Or to just
avoid lunges. Yeah. And these are the types of things that people are hearing. And so I have made it my mission to not only promote like positivity and optimism, but also to promote simple solutions to the fact of like, you can improve joint pain and you can improve joint mobility. And it's not one of those things that is this wear and tear phenomenon where there's nothing you can do about it. And so that's kind of where I have stemmed and grown. And now I'm all over the place and meeting so many people with osteoarthritis. And it has been quite the journey, but it's definitely, I'm trying to break through these stereotypes, trying to break through the doom and gloom to bring some positivity, and showing people things are possible is very powerful. And so that's what I have been trying to do these past couple of years.
I love that. And that's what caught my attention to your Instagram. We were talking about, I don't know how our Instagrams cross paths, you know, who knows, but you have simple solutions, simple things that people can do to improve, to get better. And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like doctors, while I don't think anyone means to be negative or whatever, I feel like we assume that every doctor, their wheelhouse is everything, right?
Right, right.
And that's not how it is at all. And while a doctor might be well-meaning in what they're telling you and maybe uber conservative in what they're trying to tell you, it's not always the deal. You know, we see that with nutrition all the time, you know, doctors talking about nutrition and, you know, they're not experts in nutrition. Most of them, you know, right. They can't be an expert in everything.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, of course, as far as like any healthcare professional goes that people see, it's all kind of about who you vibe with and who actually kind of understands, you know, what you're going for. Some people, you know, are better at helping a more like athletic population, and other people are better at helping, you know, kind of just a more, I just want to get through the day sort of thing. And so it's definitely all about who you vibe with. And of course, like you had just mentioned, I guarantee a lot of these people are not trying to cause harm or trying to be super negative, but it's interesting because you look at some of the, like, if you just do a Google search of osteoarthritis, I mean, you see people in wheelchairs, you see like really deformed hands. And it, I mean, that's what you like, I'm sure that, and I'd like to hear your diagnosis story, because I think when people are told, you know, you have osteoarthritis, you immediately think of these things like, oh, you know, and I mean, you being more proactive in things in the fitness and, but for someone who like, doesn't really have a fitness background or a nutrition background or, you know, something in the health and wellness field, they're like, oh my God, I have arthritis, especially if they're like 30 and it's like, what? And then they're thinking of all these pictures and then you Google and it's like degeneration, deterioration, damage. And it's all of these words that really kind of start to play into this negative connotation. And so I think word choice is a big one. So I'd love to hear your diagnosis story, because I think everybody is so different, but getting kind of a different perspective on it, I think would be.
Yeah. Great. You know, it's interesting for me, my hip had been bothering me for quite some time. I think over the course of years when it first started. And, you know, the first thing out of the gate was an impingement, which made sense to me on how it felt. Right. I did notice, I do have a slight hip shift when I squat and things. I pick that up. I don't know if anybody, but I see it. So over time, I would imagine that something's gotten out of line, out of whack, whatever. And I worked with a doc I have here locally. I call him my movement specialist. He is so all about functional movement and, really worked hard. We've worked on a lot of body parts, on shoulder and hip in particular. And we did really well at the beginning. It was super, super painful. Couldn't do a lot, but worked around it. I never stopped moving. And I think that has played a key role just in everything. I never like missed a day of training. I just had to adjust what I did as I was doing exercises he gave me to do to address what was happening. And this was before I had any kind of test done. And it went away for a while. And then it started coming back over the past like year and a half or something. And it was just getting to the point that I'm like, you know, I'm having some sharp pains now, and I'm having dull pains that felt like they were right up, way up high in the joint. And I'm like, I want to get an x-ray. I mean, I want to start with that. It's time, right?
Yeah.
We've tried this other route and we're sort of successful for a while, but at this point, no. So I got the x-ray, went to see a sports ortho doc, and he sat me down and said, look, you got two things going on. And he pointed them out clear as day. I have a nice bone spur in my hip and it's shaped like this. It's shaped like a hook, which is bizarre. He said that was bizarre to him. He never seen a bone spur that was so clearly hook defined.
Right.
Which really makes sense with the sharp pain part. You know, that part made a lot of sense now. That's what's happening, because I felt like when I had that sharp pain, if I would do these crazy manipulations of my leg, internally rotate with the leg, extend, do whatever, and it would stop. And it's like, now I see why, you know, it's caught in the spur and now it's not, kind of thing. Right.
Right. Right.
That part made sense. He goes, also, I want you to look at this. And he pointed out the arthritis on the screen. He goes, this is arthritis. He goes, he didn't use the word significant. I can't remember what he used, but he said, this is a decent amount of arthritis. It's nothing to ignore, you know? Right. And he goes, I want you to be aware of it. He goes, because that, and he started going down this road. He said that could be the issue down the road, you know, the overarching long range issue more than the bone spur potentially. He didn't think going in and getting rid of the bone spur was going to be a thing for me. I don't really understand why. And maybe we could touch on that. I think he feels like it's going to come back.
And it probably came as a result of the arthritis is probably the relationship. So, okay, we're not going to go down that road. But he did say, we had a long discussion about cortisone, and I want to talk to you about that here shortly. But he thought that I could very well be a hip replacement candidate, but down the road. And that didn't freak me out, to be honest. He said, you know, you're going to be one of the ones, because of what you do and how you approach things, that will bounce back from a hip replacement. I have no doubt, you know? So right. it was a little earth shattering from that perspective. But anyway, so here I am with this now, learning how to manipulate my training now. And to be honest, I've just taken one thing off the menu, and that is full range squats with a heavy bar on my back. That ain't happening anymore. That feels like crap. So, okay, I don't care, to be honest.
Right, right.
But I squat, it's so interesting. I squatted today. I had a bar on my back, wasn't super heavy, but I now go to parallel. That's where
okay, I was going to say like a box squat might be helpful too.
Box squats are my go-to. So I did several sets as a box squat, took the box away and just go down to that same spot. And now I iso hold it there for like 3, 4, 5 seconds. And nice. My hip actually loves this, you know, it's really funny to see that, but everything else is on the table for me, which is interesting because I mean, this is my mindset, right? I know not everyone's like that, but I can see how everyone would be completely discouraged with my diagnosis if they got that kind of diagnosis. And I just kind of looked at it as, oh, okay, well, this is getting real. Like you're getting old. Okay. I get this. And it makes sense now. Now I need to work around it. And now that my movement doc saw the x-ray, knows where the hook is, that bone spur is, now we're working specific little exercises for me just to kind of shift my pelvis a little bit to see if that doesn't help. Overall. But anyway, yeah. That's what happened.
And I think that strength totally plays a part. Because I know I've been following you for a while and you're always doing all kinds of different, you know, strength training and things like that. And absolutely, you know, understand the benefit of it and understand, you know, making it harder and, you know, all these sorts of things. I think that plays a huge role in it. Hips can be a little harder, on the conservative side, just because I've found compared to knees, they can be a little bit more sensitive. Mm. And it's really, I think the hardest part for people to truly understand at first is understanding your body. And with all, you know, the history of training and things like that, I think you already have kind of a good idea of the volume you can handle, the weight you can handle, you know, and those sorts of things. And then, so you've already kind of had that, but a lot of people I find have a hard time with that volume aspect of it, that because once you kind of cross that line of too much, that line is really thin when you have hip arthritis. And so then you can, you know, pretty quickly have an adverse reaction, pain, stiffness to doing too much. And that can be really hard to find out because a lot of times it's trial and error of
it. I'll be honest. It was for me too.
Yeah.
It was for me too. Maybe it didn't take me as long as someone else that doesn't have the experience. But it's exactly that. I mean, and sometimes when you're doing stuff in the moment, you feel great.
Right. And then it's afterwards.
And then it's like, I shouldn't have put the extra 10 on or something, you know, I unfortunately learned the hard way.
Yes.
You know, with a hip that was sore for a week because of that.
And like I said, that's kind of the hardest part, I think, with hip arthritis is they are more sensitive, but the recovery time for a joint replacement is much quicker typically for a hip than a knee. Cause I used to actually do home care and saw people after total knee and hip replacements. And the, you know, if somebody had a hip replacement, they were just like up and moving around and really didn't have much of an issue. The knee was a little harder just because it's harder to get that range of motion and all kinds of those things. Pain tends to be a little bit higher, but hip replacements are a little bit easier in the experience that I've had with the surgeons and things that I was working under. But yeah, so that aspect is true that the recovery typically tends to be a little quicker, but of course, you know, you want to, you know, try conservative management first to make sure, you know, you can kind of prolong it as much as you can and figure out all those factors, but.
Let's break something down here out of the get-go. What are the different types of arthritises? Because I know, you know, you hear osteo, you hear rheumatoid. What are the different types and what are they?
So osteoarthritis typically tends to be like the arthritis people typically talk about. So, you know, I have hip arthritis, I have knee arthritis. That's typically the umbrella that it kind of falls under. And that type of arthritis is typically characterized by pain and stiffness, and especially stiffness in the morning that tends to kind of resolve after 15, 20 minutes of up and moving around. Some instability can happen too, but it primarily starts on one side of the body and then can progress to the other side or progress to other joints, depending on how you compensate.
Is that because the other side is trying to compensate?
For the most part, yeah. But it also depends on, like, if you are, say, for example, eating a high inflammatory diet or, you know, those sorts of things, that those other factors can start to implicate other joints too. But primarily it's compensation is when you actually start to see that pain really take off. Mm-hmm. And so it usually starts on one side, and it's usually in some of the larger joints, hip, knee, spine, but you can get it in hands, et cetera. Rheumatoid arthritis is another very common form of arthritis, and it's actually considered an autoimmune condition. I don't see a ton of people with rheumatoid arthritis, but sometimes you can have both. And this condition tends to have a lot more systemic involvement. So like fever, nausea, it starts to play with, you know, how your body just feels. A lot of times pain happens bilaterally. So maybe you have all of a sudden kind of have pain in both hands, or you have pain in both knees or feet. It typically tends to impact smaller joints, but it can also impact larger joints as well. And then there's psoriatic arthritis that I don't know honestly a ton about it, but it primarily impacts tendons, and it can create some stiffness and really can create some mobility issues. But those are kind of the three main types. And then I particularly see people with osteoarthritis kind of in this realm of just, I have arthritis sort of thing, and the arthritis that people commonly think about. Those are the three kinds.
What is actually happening in the joint? What is arthritis actually doing?
So it's actually not necessarily as straightforward as we'd like to think, like, oh, my cartilage is wearing away, so now my bones are just, you know, kind of rubbing together. And there's a lot more physiologically that's going on that the research has really kind of started to look at, I would say, in the past 10, 20 years, that we have some of this inflammation. And what happens is you have a capsule kind of around your joint called the synovium. And what happens is that can get really irritated by a lot of repetitive motions and not getting a lot of variety. The inflammation can come in and kind of infiltrate. Dehydration and, you know, lack of fluid. That's why some like hyaluronic acid can be helpful, because it brings that fluid back in. When we don't have fluid, say like in cold weather, is one instance of that. Weather can kind of impact that fluidity in the joint. And so it tends to create more friction. And so then that can lead to earlier irritation, which then can lead to pain. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. And so you're essentially just kind of creating this irritation, whether it's that synovium, because the bones don't have nerves. And so when you say, like, when people are told, you know, I'm bone on bone, you immediately imagine two bones like grinding together.
And all this pain.
Yes. But then some people can be bone on bone and not have any pain, nor even know that they are. And so it's all about, again, that irritation aspect. What is irritating your joint? And that's why it can explain why people with bone on bone knees or bone on bone hips can actually find pain relief by pulling out that irritation. So if we think about it in a factor of your joint is angry for a reason, and we have to figure out why, whether it's movement compensations, whether it's inflammation, whether it's likely a combination, we have to figure out why they're irritated. And thinking about it that way can also kind of bring back some power that, like, hey, I can do something about this, versus, you know, I'm just bone on bone and, you know, there's nothing I can do. Right. So it's basically in a factor of like irritation. There's lots that goes on physiologically, but for the most part, that's kind of a simplified version.
Got it. And I appreciate the simplification.
Yes. Don't even understand half the physiological kind of depth that it goes into chemical pathways.
I didn't know that. I mean, So I'm curious, when the doc pointed out to me where the arthritis is, what is showing up on the x-ray? Like, it's this cloudy area in the joint. It's clear as day to see. what is actually being shown? What is that?
So one of the things that could be shown is it's called a bone marrow lesion. And it's basically kind of an outgrowth that can lead to some of that irritation. You can also look at like the decreasing joint space, which is a little bit easier to see in a knee versus a hip, but the space kind of, the bones kind of like look like they're almost like touching. So that can be a part of it too, but a lot of times it's characterized as a bone marrow lesion, it's called. So it's just kind of a edema kind of off the bone, irritating the synovium. And that's typically what can be seen on x-rays. You can see, but maybe if you have like an MRI or something, you can see like maybe a little divot in the cartilage or something like that. But x-rays typically just show the bone. And so that kind of bony outgrowth can just be some irritation, some inflammation, some kind of bony edema.
Is the x-ray the typical kind of first diagnosis step? Like, is that where people will mostly find out about it?
Well, and that's kind of the hard part, because there's not really a test that you can say, oh, you know, hey, I have osteoarthritis, take a blood test or something. Like rheumatoid arthritis, you can test for the rheumatoid factor and things like that. But so they usually kind of use a couple of different things in conjunction to diagnose osteoarthritis. One of them is an image. So whether it's an x-ray, MRI, or both, that is a starting point. But a lot of times that is ordered based upon the symptoms that you're describing. So whether that's stiffness, whether that's pain, whether that's especially stiffness in the morning, whether that's just kind of feeling unstable, feeling like your leg's going to give way. A lot of times like an MRI will rule out some, you know, ligament damage. It will rule out some other injuries. You can see the meniscus. So they kind of use these images twofold, one to kind of rule out other things. And then two, to really just kind of see what the joint looks like. Because just because you have some decreased joint space, or maybe you have a loss of cartilage, or maybe even you do have some degree of a bone marrow lesion or something, it may not always bring on pain. That so an x-ray is, the image is just part of it. You cannot just go take an x-ray of someone off the street and diagnose them with arthritis likely. You need to have some of these other symptoms and have some, and the hard part is it's also a grab bag of symptoms. Like I have a blog post on like 9 or 10 common symptoms with osteoarthritis. Some people experience instability. Some people experience high levels of pain. Some people experience swelling. And so it's kind of this grab bag of symptoms, but typically you have about 2 to maybe even 5 or 6 of these symptoms, but it's kind of a whole picture diagnosis just because there's not that specific test. So an x-ray is part of it, but an x-ray is not all-inclusive in the diagnosis and understanding. So you have to have some of these other symptoms and some of these other things that you had described have been going on for a couple of years. And so you have to have kind of this history too. And then along with the image, x-ray, or MRI.
Yeah. They start putting pieces of a puzzle together. It sounds
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, going back to my bone spur too. I mean, I'm assuming that the bone spur is as a result of probably the arthritis, you know, I'm wondering if you could talk about bone spurs and the relation to arthritis, but what bone spurs are, why we get them. Cause I think this is something I really didn't understand about bone spurs either until I got one of those.
Yes. And so bone spurs are kind of hard just because there's not necessarily, there's still some kind of up in the air of what causes them. Sometimes it could be from a movement compensation, especially like if it's in like that special, special shape. It could be just the way that, you know, some cartilage or something got kind of stuck under the, where the hip ball goes into the joint itself and kind of made almost that like little bit of a hook sort of thing. I know a lot of people that get like bone spurs in their feet and things like that. It's just kind of an outgrowth that just can get irritated because it messes with how everything else moves together. And especially when you're talking about the joint space, there's not a ton of room. room. And so now when you start to introduce something, whether it's, you know, a bony just outgrowth, or it's, there are some other physiological processes that go into bone spurs and things like that, but you introduce some foreign thing into the joint, then things start moving differently and things can't move as well as they used to. And so then you start to have compensations and those sorts of things. And without kind of knowing what is maybe leading to this bone spur, removing it may not be helpful either, because like he had mentioned, it may come back and it may kind of come back in a different spot or may come back, you know, larger sorts of things. And so it's kind of hard to tell what exactly causes them. But it's definitely introducing kind of a foreign object into the joint and then trying to, your body's now trying to figure out kind of how to move around it and how to, you know, make do with this less space that it has.
It sounds like your body is almost kind of going into protective mode. Like I'm trying to almost protect you by growing this, because you're moving like this or what the reason that it comes, I don't know, but I feel like, and I've been reading a lot about bone spurs recently as well, just to try to learn more. And I think I read somewhere where someone said bone spurs are your body's way of protecting you. They grow them out of a necessity, whatever the necessity is.
Okay.
Which kind of aligns up with what you said, you know, your body could potentially be growing that because there's been a compensation now, you know, and it's trying to help, you know. I don't know. I know the doc I saw, was pretty adamant about not taking action on it right now, just because he felt like it was going to come back. So is our bone spurs just kind of an active, once you have one, and let's say I did get it taken care of, shave it down or whatever, that it would automatically come back? Chances are higher it would come back. Is there anything based on that?
I feel like chances may be higher that it comes back. I wouldn't say like it automatically would grow back. I think a lot of the times it's based upon movement and how your body moves and how it compensates and adapts and things. And so I think that it would just potentially kind of gradually come back, kind of like a cyst or something like that. Like if you drain a cyst, but then it's likely going to come back. Depending on the reasoning behind potentially why it's happening, which again can be really hard to tell. And so a lot of it can just be movement based. And so, I mean, there's potential that it could come back just based upon your, you know, body composition and all kinds of different things. But it's not typically like a guarantee. But it's just, it definitely does kind of throw a wrench into things movement wise and can, you know, limit some mobility depending on where it is, can cause some pain depending on where it is. And so it definitely can impact things, but it's just kind of figuring out ways around it. Your body will adapt to be able to kind of work around and be able to move as efficiently as you can. But yeah, it's not necessarily a guarantee, but there is a high chance it could come back. One, because you've already had one. And then two, because we may not know the exact reason why.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. You know, it was interesting before I had the test done, it was on Thanksgiving actually. And I was in a Starbucks with my family. We were heading out of town and literally I took a step off to the side and I couldn't put any weight on my foot. And I'm like, oh crap, here we go. You know, I'm in the middle of Starbucks. I can't move. I'm in line and I can't move. And so here I am grabbing the case where they have all the drinks or whatever. And I'm extending my leg behind me, internally rotating it, trying to get it in the middle of Starbucks. People are looking at me like, dude, yes, you have to stretch right now. I mean, I was like, no, I'm just trying to be able to walk so I can move up here. It's crazy how you learn to adapt. Like that was instinctive to me. I don't know why, but I knew I had to get something moving and I did. And then I could walk fine. It was like nothing happened. I went from not being able to put any weight on that foot to in a few seconds being able to walk like a normal human being. It's crazy.
Yes, it definitely is. And it's just, you know, kind of one of those things that something may have gotten caught, that bone spur might have gotten caught.
Yeah.
And then once it kind of relaxes, then that happens a lot in the knees with like meniscus, the menisci, I guess. But you know, it gets kind of in the wrong position because the meniscus is in between the two joint or the two bones of the knee joint. Mm-hmm. And so when you step, it compresses it, but there can be like degenerative meniscus tears. And sometimes that's what people describe is kind of stepping and just feeling like this immense sharp pain, but then it just kind of goes away or maybe lingers for a couple minutes and then just goes away like normal. And so it just kind of gets back into the place it needs to, or, you know, something like that. And so, and of course, if it's happening more frequently, then it may be serious, but yeah, typically it doesn't tend to impact a lot if, you know, just every once in a while you step wrong or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Which is kind of, I'm learning, you know, what's interesting for me, our kitchen table is a countertop kind of height table. And when I slide out of my chair, I used to just turn that my right hip just to get out. Oh, no more, no more. That is my trigger. That is the absolute worst trigger for my hip, is how I get out of that chair. It is crazy when I just slide out with my legs parallel like this versus turning 90 degrees and with that one hip, it's a completely different thing. And my husband says, now the trick is for me to get out of the chair on the other side. Like, I'm right yeah. dominant, so I'm always getting out towards the right. He says, you should probably try to get out towards the left. And I'm like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that. And then yes. I tried it the other day and I'm like, wait a minute.
Yes. And it's really just all about adapting and finding different ways to move, different ways to do things, and finding those specific triggers. And like I said, that can be one of the hard parts about it, is if you're not necessarily aware of how you're moving or aware of your body, or have someone else, you know, just to kind of point something out. I mean, it can be really hard to figure out what those triggers are. And like I said, in hips, they are a little bit more, I feel like, impactful, and they're a little bit more severe than, or they can be, than like in the knee, for example. And so it's definitely just kind of being aware of, okay, if you experience pain, what changed? Like, what did I do right in that moment? Or if you experience pain, like say the next day, for example, I always tell people to think about, okay, what changed? Like, look back at your day. Did you eat something different? Did you do something different? Did you, you know, get out of the chair or something differently, or ride longer in the car, or, you know, things like that. And just kind of think back to what you changed, and then figure out from there how to go about doing things maybe a little bit differently, modifying certain activities. It's not always like black and white, like, oh, I did this, so that's what's causing it. But it can be a combination of things. Yeah. But it's definitely just being more aware of how you're moving, and then kind of seeing if you can tie it into increased pain, increased stiffness, that sort of thing.
I really think that kind of awareness is just so helpful just anyway. And we would be better off if we did it just anyway. But I think for this, absolutely. Just even looking at your workout the day before, if your hips really sore or something, when I was doing that, okay, what did I do? Oh yeah. You know what? I did do too many full body weight squats. That's just not going to work for me anymore. It's just not going to work. And then try the box squats instead or whatever, right. You know, going ass to grass is just not important to me anymore. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, and the hard part with that though, too, is a lot of times arthritic joints don't particularly love like end range of motion. So when you kind of get into that really deep flexion, a lot of people with knee arthritis don't particularly like deep squats either, just because it's that deep end range of motion. But again, I mean, not necessarily required for most activity daily, unless, you know, you're doing some like powerlifting or something that. But, but for the most part, squats typically feel good, or they can feel good with certain ranges of motion. Like you said, going to parallel, getting up and down from a chair, a box squat, you can modify those. And that is a 100% guaranteed activity that you need to know how to do, or else your life will be miserable. And so it's just kind of finding ways to get stronger, ways to show your body they can actually squat. And again, that's one of the things people are told, oh, just don't squat anymore. It's like, okay, well, so you're just going to walk around standing. Spend your life in a standing.
Spend your life standing. Yeah.
And never sit down or never get in a car. So it's just, it's so possible to learn how to squat. But again, it's these kind of making some of these modifications if you need to, not being able to lift as heavy or having to change the range of motion, but it's totally possible. It's just kind of finding those. And then also acceptance, I think, is a big part of it, that, you know, accepting like, okay, I may not be able to do like a full squat with heavy weight, but hey, I can do, you know, a box squat, you know, sort of thing. And so acceptance, I think, is a big part of it too, because it can get you in trouble if you don't, and you continue to say, you know what, well, maybe if I just keep doing this, it'll get better. No pain, no gain.
And
it tends to go down this negative spiral. So acceptance is also a big part of it, but finding other things you can do can be really powerful too.
I think that is key. And I've said from the beginning, whether it was my shoulder or my hip, I've never missed a day of training. And people are like, what? You didn't? No, because I stopped focusing on what I can't do. And I went into the gym and found things that I can do. Literally, I tell people, take a pad of paper and a pencil with you to the gym, go through your program and take stuff for a test drive. You'll know right away if it's pain. If it's pain, it goes in the no column for now. And if you can do it, maybe limited range of motion, cool. Then that's something you can do. And when you focus on what you can do instead of what you can't do, then you continue to progress, you know?
Yes. And with chronic pain, I think that's a big part of it, because it's a lot of perseveration on things you can't do. Don't do this, avoid this, blah, blah, blah. But whenever I see someone, you know, one-on-one or work with someone that has arthritis, I mean, the ultimate goal of every session is to find at least 4 movements that feel good and that are addressing the certain things that we need to, but at least 4 things that actually feel good. So at that point, one, exercise is not making you worse or feel worse when it's done. Like, a lot of times people are like, you know, I'm going to PT, I'm going to this, but, you know, I just have a lot of pain afterwards. That's not good.
Yeah.
And that's likely you're just not doing the right movements. And so a lot of people think, you know, pain and torture and physical therapy and all kinds of things, but it doesn't have to be that way. It's finding certain movements. There are like a gajillion exercises. There are like so many exercises, so many variations that you can do, that you can find a few exercises, at least to start with, that really do make you feel good and start to address the things that you need to. And I think that's the most empowering part of it, is that it's not this cookie cutter. You need to do this, 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 and this. It's, we need to figure out what's going on with your joint, how your joint responds, and then we go from there as far as finding a plan forward.
I'm so glad you said that, because I get asked all the time, what exercises am I doing for my hip? And I'm like, you know, this is what was prescribed for me
exactly,
based on my particular scenario. You know, it may not be appropriate for someone else, but it is appropriate for me, because I have been seen by somebody who prescribed these for me. And I think that's super important, that if anyone's having any kind of joint issue, you feel like there is an issue, to go get seen and get a diagnosis of, or rule something out. It's better to do that and then get a plan of action than to try to guess and do random exercises off the internet, you know?
Exactly. And that's what can be kind of hard about social media. It can absolutely be helpful as far as, you know, finding maybe certain things that you hadn't thought about or that sort of thing. But also, I get a lot of people who are like, you know what, I keep trying all these exercise programs and things, and I just end up, you know, hurting myself. And I also get a lot of questions, like specifically about when I, because I post all sorts of different exercises and things of things that have worked for other people in the past. And, you know, people always comment specifically, you know, like, how many reps of this should I do? Or is this safe to do with XYZ? And it's like, it really depends on how it feels for you. Yeah. Because if someone else has the same XYZ, it may feel completely different, even if it's kind of the same, you got kind of the same things going on. And so it's definitely all about kind of finding options. That's the biggest thing, is knowing that there are options of things you can do for movement. So for example, you know, you post a box squat or something, hey, you know, I have hip arthritis, blah, 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 this works for me. Maybe someone who's having a hard time with squatting may see that and say, you know what, hey, maybe I should try that. And then maybe it will feel good for them,
but maybe
it won't. And then it's like finding, you have to go kind of dig a little bit deeper. So I think it's definitely twofold. It can be very positive as far as showing options, showing possibilities, or somebody with hip arthritis sees you maybe doing a squat or something and is like, oh, oh, well, maybe that is possible for me. And then they kind of seek out other things. And so it can be very motivating and empowering in that aspect, and also providing some different ways of thinking about things. But it also can be, you know, trying something and, you know, people hurting themselves, or so you have to be absolutely very, very careful about what you try. Always use support, always, you know, make sure that you feel balanced, you feel confident, and all of those things before you start trying to lift a ton of weight or, you know, doing things that may not feel great for you.
For sure. You know, let's talk about some movement patterns that people may be surprised that are not off the table, you know, and I know we've been talking about hip primarily because of my scenario, but I know you do a lot of work with knees and, you know, Jordan and I in the inner circle, we always get a lot of people asking about, you know, exercise for bad knees, you know, bad in quotes knees, whatever that means, you know, it would be interesting to kind of bust some myths here, because I feel like there are a couple of exercises out there that are getting demonized, and maybe don't need to be demonized, you know?
And really there's not particularly any exercise that's really off the table. It really depends on how things feel for you. So yes, a lunge may not feel great right now.
And when you're talking about lunge, are you talking about a forward lunge or reverse lunge or a static lunge or any of them?
So any of them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I find putting your front foot on something like a box can be really helpful, because it's that kind of the reason why a lot of times lunges can be problematic, and squats too, for that matter, is kind of the knees over toes phenomenon. And I don't know if you follow Ben at all with knees over toes, but it's kind of that thing that if your knees are going over your toes and you're not used to it, then it can put pressure on your knees. Mm-hmm. It can not feel great. And so lunges typically tend to kind of throw you in a little bit more of that forward position. So I've noticed that if you elevate the front foot, then it doesn't put you in that much of a kind of that knees over toes phenomenon. Now, of course, it is not bad to go knees over toes, but it likely is not going to feel great for you if you're having pain right away.
Yeah.
So lunges, I have people get back to regular lunges. A lot of times I find people have a hard time with lunges that you step and then come back, or like you go into a reverse lunge and then you come back, like a moving lunge where you're constantly stepping forwards and backwards. A static lunge, or like a split squat, where one foot's in front of the other and you're in this wide stance, but you're just staying there and you're going down and up. That can be a little bit more helpful as far as kind of keeping pressure low on the knees, but lunges can totally be done. And they obviously promote single leg strength, which is of the utmost importance when you have arthritis in any joint. So that one is not off the table, but it's just finding modifications for you that, you know, just going and doing a lunge probably is not going to feel great, but it's not something that you have to avoid, because if you ever want to climb stairs or you ever want to get better at squatting, you probably need to do some degree of a lunge. Squats is obviously the number one thing that I see, that, you know, oh, I can't do this, or it feels weird, or I have pain. And that's just primarily of kind of a more of a knee dominant squat than a hip dominant squat that I typically see. So when you squat, your hips should bend first. And a lot of times it's the knees, especially in a pathological, painful sense, people just go kind of jet their knees out. But then it's funny, because then you put them in front of a chair and say, sit down. And that's typically, I mean, that is a squat, but it's so different the way that people do that. So, and I do this experiment probably with almost everyone I see that, you know, okay, do like a free squat, just standing there. Oh, it hurts my knees, you know? And then, okay, now stand in front of this chair and sit down and stand up. How did that feel? Oh, that felt pretty good. And it's like, it's the same squat, but it's just the mechanics that there's a disconnect somewhere. And I don't know if that was just like evolution or, you know, something, how we learn to do that. So that's a big one.
I see that too. And it's so interesting. Box squats are a great cure for this too.
Exactly. You know? You have no choice but to sit back.
Yeah, exactly. And it's for some reason, there's a mental component to this. When you don't have the box behind you, your stance is different. You're a little bit afraid. You get the box behind you, even better, straddle the corner of that box, sit down and stand up, man. It's like, Yeah. Oh, this is it. You know, now we're in a wider stance. Your hips have place to drop. It's more comfortable. Your knees are now in a better alignment with everything.
Right. Yeah. It's just more confident, I feel like, just because you know that something's behind you. And it's all about, especially when first learning, it's setting yourself up in these situations where you really don't have a choice but to do it right. Like a box squat, or for example, I use all the time, like people elevate their heels on dumbbells. So you set dumbbells on the ground and you put your heels on the dumbbells, toes on the ground. You cannot go forward because you have to go back or else you're going to likely fall.
Yeah.
So it's kind of setting people up and doing a suspension strap squats the same way. You can't really jet forward. You have to sit back. And so it's learning that way first and then making it less scary. And then obviously progressing to other variations and free squats and things like that. And then stairs is another one. And, you know, I posted something about this today about, you know, people are scared of stairs, which is definitely understandable because if you have pain, you don't feel stable, then stairs are going to be scary, especially going down. But that is like same thing as a step up and, you know, all of those sorts of things. That is, again, totally doable. You just have to make sure that you have the right strength, especially single leg strength, to be able to do that. And also an interesting thing is you have to, for stairs in particular, you have to be able to move a little bit quicker. Like you have to generate a little bit of power to be able to, you know, lift your body weight to the next step. And everything that's arthritis, I guarantee if people listening, look, Google search like arthritis exercises, you'd see four, you know, articles pop up, all of them, you know, take it gentle, go slow, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it doesn't always have to be slow. We have to start to move a little bit quicker. Obviously in the beginning, yes, totally. But high impact is necessary. You don't have to just do swimming for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, if you want to get good at stairs, you have to get moving a little bit quicker. And so I'm doing a stairs workshop this weekend, but it's just kind of all about finding ways that you can train to make yourself successful at these things. Standing at the counter and doing like kicking your leg out to the side is not going to likely get you better at stairs. No. You have to kind of progress to doing things that are going to specifically get you there.
Yeah.
And a lot of the typical like arthritis type exercises are a good start, but they're likely not going to get you to some of these more higher level tasks.
You know, it's the same thing with just training in general. You know, if you want to get better at chin-ups, you have to practice chin-ups.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are a lot of other exercises you can do to help with that strength, but really, if you want to get better at chin-ups, you got to do chin-ups. You know, same thing with stairs. You can do all the other exercises, whatever, but really at some point you're going to have to get on stairs.
Yes.
and practice stairs. Maybe you're supporting yourself or whatever you're doing at the beginning, but and I love that. And I love the overarching message here. And I don't want people to miss this, that you're talking about these things are doable. Like arthritis is not the death sentence. It's not like you can't. It's like, no, take the word can't out. It's you can still do stuff.
Exactly. And I think that's the biggest part that I've noticed is, again, just showing people it's possible, showing people that, you know, you can go up and down the stairs again, you can squat, you can, you know, do all these movements that you're initially told not to, you can even run in certain circumstances with the right strength and the right stability. And if your joints are prepared for it. Now, one thing I did want to touch on is the specificity aspect of like, if you want to get better at stairs, do stairs. The caveat to that is walking.
Yeah.
The more walking you do, if it's painful, if it hurts, if it's hard, the more you do it, it's not technically going to get better. A lot of times I see when people are walking for exercise, you know, they have pain afterwards, or it's just not getting any easier. They just, oh, okay, I need to walk more. It's actually the other side. We need to work on strengthening. We need to work on balance. We need to do this, and this. That doesn't necessarily involve specifically walking. Cause I mean, a lot of people really like walking, but you need variety. So you kind of have to have both. You have to have specificity. And then you also have to have those supporting accessories.
Absolutely love that. And it's so interesting. As you were saying that, I'm like, you know, my hip doesn't always like to walk, you know, and everyone's into counting steps and all this. And it's like, my hip loves the elliptical. Oh my God. That is like the miracle drug for me right now. Just, I do it after every leg workout for sure. And my gosh, my hip just feels so much better with that. Is just what works for me, right?
Sure.
And I think it's making walking better for me.
Yes.
And, you know, and just getting the joint moving or the blood flowing, all of that. But it's interesting because walking has not felt good. It is one of the last things in the world that I want to do, but getting on the elliptical, I would do night and day right now because it feels so good. So I love that.
Yes. Yes. And so it's all about kind of finding, again, those movements that you can strengthen. You can really kind of help hips in particular. It's well, knees as well. It's so important to build up that single leg strength, that single leg stability, and stay in a range of motion that's not going to necessarily hurt at first, and then progressing into other things.
What a great message that is. Cause I think one of the first things people think about with arthritis, especially knee arthritis, is okay, single leg exercises are out.
Right.
Right.
No, they need to be in.
They need to be in.
Like, but in a way that's not going to flare things up. Cause that is that's the hardest part is, yeah, you know, you should do lunges and you should do squats and things, but if they don't feel good at first, then it's definitely finding ways that you can work around it. But yes, they should definitely be in, but making sure that you're doing it in a way that's not.
Love that. I want to hit two more things real quick. One is, what is your thought on the use of cortisone shots if the pain is just more constant?
So I typically recommend a cortisone shot or at least exploring it if you have pain that does not respond to anything. So, you know, say you, for example, if you had, you know, gone to the gym, you're trying to do all these things, you've modified, you've, you know, sought out help, and it, nothing just seems to be working. You just constantly have this, whether it's dull pain or more severe pain, and it just is not going away. A cortisone shot can be really helpful. But again, on the other side of things, if you know that, you know, exercise makes you feel better, that, you know, you've noticed that if you start eating better, then you don't have as much pain, that sort of thing, then relying on a cortisone shot isn't particularly going to be helpful and can actually weaken some of the tendons and some of the ligaments if they are gotten repetitively. I have a lot of people who I used to see in home care who, you know, would get a cortisone shot, feel pretty good, kind of just go back to their typical routine. Then it'd come back. The pain would come back. They'd go in and, oh, my 3 months, I must be getting close to my 3 months, go back and get it. And then, you know, continue, not necessarily changing much in between. But I always tell people that if you get one, like if you get a cortisone shot, what's your plan? How are you going to maximize this pain relief? Because if you take the edge off, which a lot of times a cortisone shot does, how are you going to make it last?
Well, you know, I'm just like so excited that you said this because I've had cortisone shots before in my shoulder. And the reason I feel like it was successful for me is because once I had it, I felt like $1 million, right? And the problem is when you feel like $1 million, you want to go out and just do the same crap that got you in there in the first place, right? You don't change anything.
Or not doing anything.
Not doing anything, right? Right. And that's not going to help you. You know, when I had it in my shoulder, I scaled everything back from and started studying my movement patterns because it's something I got to that point for a reason, right?
Right.
And so I feel like they can be successful if when you have it, you now start to become more aware of what you're doing and analyze things a little bit more. I think then, yeah, they could be really helpful. But I think they get a bad rap. I really do, you know, from the people that just get it, feel like $1 million. Okay, I'm back at it. Let's go, you know, and there's no change.
Yeah. And then of course, some people don't notice a change at all, and which is, you know, that can happen. And, but it's that kind of repetitive nature. And so it's always kind of having a plan of, okay, how are you going to be more aware? What are you going to do to strengthen while you are feeling good? And then you don't necessarily want to rely on them totally. There are so many other injections and I get questions all the time. It's really just the hard part with all of these types of injections is it works for some, it doesn't work for others. Same thing, stem cells, PRP. I mean, all these types of questions, I think people are just looking for like, yes, it will work for you. And then you're just not going to get that answer. Yeah. And so it's, you know, talking to other people, getting the experiences that your doctor has had with other patients that maybe present similar to you, and just kind of, it's just not a guarantee, which can be a difficult thing to kind of navigate. But yeah, kind of same thing goes with a lot of the other injections. Works for some, doesn't work for others.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about these. The last thing I want to hit on are inflammatory foods. What are they? So people might know. And then the benefit or not benefit of joint supplements.
Yes. So both kind of loaded questions. For just kind of a superficial approach to inflammatory foods. I'm not a dietitian, but in the research and things, a lot of the inflammatory foods, a lot of them are processed. I mean, a lot of them are foods that you know aren't great for you anyway.
Okay. It's not rocket science here, right?
Exactly. Although there are certain instances where, say, you're eating a protein bar or something, which, okay, you think, oh yeah, this is good for me. It's got protein in it, but then it's got high sugar and the ingredient list is 30 ingredients long. Yeah. And so it can be really deceiving to kind of figure out, even like these healthy, like organic foods, like you just kind of assume it's good for you, but then, you know, it's got this long list of ingredients. And so it's definitely just being aware of what you're putting in your body, looking at the nutrition facts, looking at what's in it, and just not being deceived by it. Obviously, whole foods are going to be better. I mean, there's
nutrient dense, the basic nutrient dense foods that we all need to eat most.
That you know are, yes, that you have fruits and vegetables. Like, it's not necessarily like it's, you know, eat. People are always asking, you know, which foods do I need to be eating? Like, what what do I exactly need to be eating? And it's, you know, it's not that necessarily that it needs to be that exact. I mean, you can have all sorts of different things, but it's just being aware of what is in your body. Mm-hmm. And supplements are hit or miss. I always recommend, if you're thinking about taking a supplement, pay the, $5 or $10. It's called consumerlab.com. Mm. And this, I'm not like sponsored by them or anything, but what they do is they take common or popular supplement brands, and they also have like protein powders and things, but they take them and they break them down by ingredients. They do something in the lab where they like take apart things. Anyways, they figure out ways that, or like if they are saying that they have the ingredients that they say they do, or that they have the certain concentrations of things that they say they do. Again, it's something I get questions about all the time. And it's, you know, you have to look at, you know, what's in the supplements. Like, not every turmeric supplement is maybe helpful, or, you know, not every fish oil may be helpful. Again, people do respond differently to different things. So if you find an approved one on the consumer lab, you can try that. Don't try like 5 different fish oil or turmeric at the same time. Try one at a time and see if they make a difference. I think a lot of people out there are taking supplement, like just a lot of supplements, and it may not be doing much good. And so it's really just kind of doing it for a month. The good thing about it is a lot of them are pretty inexpensive, like $20. And I usually tell people, you know, try it and see. The side effects usually aren't.
Is there any just general sweeping stuff about a good quality joint supplement could be beneficial to some people?
No, I typically, some of the joint compounds, like the joint health ones that have like a bunch of different things, again, can not have the things that they say they do. And so the joint combination ones is also a tab on the consumer lab that you can go through. No, there's not necessarily. Turmeric and fish oil are two of the ones that I typically recommend to start with. And then it's just kind of going from there, finding these quality brands and then just seeing if it works. If it doesn't, you're out $20. If it does, then hey, you found a $20, you know, supplement that can help you. And so it's one of those things that it might be worth a try, but don't expect it to be like some miracle drug.
100%. That's great. Well, I got to tell you, this has been phenomenal.
Yes.
I feel like I've learned so much and had a lot of stuff validated by you. And I really appreciate that. It's been great to listen to you and learn all about the different kinds of arthritis and how it manifests and all of this. And I think everyone's going to really, really enjoy this. Yes. Can you tell everyone out there where they can find you?
Yes. So I probably go to Instagram, although I am everywhere. It's Adventure Alive. So my business is called Keep the Adventure Alive. So you can also go to my website, but I'm on YouTube. If you search my name, I am on TikTok. So I am everywhere. If you just Google search my name, you may find the best place to find me, but I'd go to Instagram at Adventure Alive.
I love that. Thank you. Well, yes. Thank you, Alyssa. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming on and sharing all your knowledge with us. And we will do this again soon.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
Bye.